Fifth-year radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
The program, co-hosted by myself, Andre Lopez Turner, and Juan Toledo, in association with Extra Radio 1.com, Artifacto, and ZTR Radio, welcomes one of South Africa's leading artists, Georgina Donnelly, into the studio. She brings her distinctive upbeat paintings to Mayfair soon on June the 11th, specifically for her first London solo show called Carpe Diem. A variety of landscapes inspired by the intense colours of her native land and the enriched and challenging journey in life that she has taken. Her first inkling for art occurred at the age of 7 when her mother took her to the studio of the iconic South African artist Nina Campbell-Quinn. Quote, she looked like a Maharani, Donnelly recalls. She used to wear this great big jewel on her forehead with her hair scraped back, and she just floated around and painted in the studio with very big windows and surrounded by exotic trees. It was a wonderful, magical place to be for a 7-year-old, as you could imagine. Donnelly's broad outlook, love of life, and richness of her experiences are widely represented in her palette. She has lived and worked across the world, already speaking 6 languages as a teenager by the time she moved to Paris to pursue interpreting and translation at Dauphine University, then Vienna, New York, Isle of Wight, and London. You can find her in canvases, faces from remote corners of the world, interwoven with some idyllic paths and plenty of fish, the result of their passion for water and the freedom of their movement, which she admires as a sort of energetic contortionism. Very impressive. You were 7 years of age and you were inspired to paint, I presume?
Absolutely. Couldn't get enough of it. You know, either you rode horses or you did something creative, and I did both, so I was really lucky.
Yeah.
But the painting was absolutely phenomenal.
Big family?
No, I just have a brother who actually is a very good painter. And, no, just the two of us.
And parents painting too? Or
no, my father was quite able, but he didn't really.
Okay.
He dabbled. He was an engineer, and so everything was very, very precise and organized. And, you know, if you painted a tree with a green trunk rather than a brown trunk, he'd fly into a rage saying, yeah, you know, you complete idiot. And then I went to be with Nina Campbell-Quine, who was so exciting and interesting, and things just changed, and she just opened doors in my mind, and I was just able to take it from there.
Yeah.
And so I've painted really all my life, but I took up ceramics much, much later when I actually moved to London after New York and Paris and Vienna and California.
Okay.
And I really loved that. And so when I wasn't being a radio journalist, which was what I was doing at the same
really?
Time. Yes.
Incredible.
I was sort of the fluff for South African Broadcasting, the women's program.
Okay.
And I then went and did the ceramics, and I absolutely adored it.
Yeah.
But because they sort of thought that I was just there to fill in time, they never taught me anything, so I'm completely self-taught. I used to have to just watch people and see what they were doing.
Yeah.
And think, gosh, that's quite interesting. Let me try. And then I'd push it a bit further and I'd do something else. And I'm not a potter in the true sense of the word.
Yeah.
I'm much more of an artist and a sculptural ceramicist. And I build everything with great big sausages, so coiling. I could never make anything worth anything on a pot, on a wheel.
Yeah.
It was all too time consuming, and not even that, it was all too precise.
Yeah.
And it's not that I'm not precise, but I'm just sort of, my things are too big and I couldn't ever do anything like that. And so that's why I loved painting when I came back to it. And I stopped it for a long time because my husband suddenly decided he wanted to paint.
Oh.
And when he decided he wanted to do something, that's what he did. And, you know, sort of 500 or 600 paintings later, he became really quite good. So that's when I concentrated chiefly on ceramics, and I loved that.
So while your husband was painting. You were doing ceramics.
I was doing ceramics. Yeah.
Okay. It was a conscientious decision not to compete with your husband.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. It was just much easier. You know, peace in the home and all that.
Yeah.
It was just much easier, and it just sort of worked that way. And
yeah.
So I was able to give a lot of energy to ceramics.
And this globe-trotting existence. It started obviously in Paris.
Yes.
And from Paris you decided to go to what, the United States?
No, I went from Paris because my mother thought that all girls had to be finished in Paris. And if they didn't go to the Sorbonne, they were unfinished. So off I
see.
Went and didn't go. And I had a wonderful time there and became a porcelain restorer. And oh, we had an amazing time with another South African, in fact.
Yeah.
And she used to do all the very, very fine Chinese, extraordinary Chinese and Japanese porcelain.
Yeah.
And I did all the Hispano-Moresque and the French faience and the soft paste. And it was absolutely amazing because we just learnt, you know, by dealing with things, and we learnt to be with porcelain, with the things that we use in everyday life. But they just happened to be made 400, 500, 600, 700, 800 years ago. And some of them were exceptionally beautiful, sawn and, you know, extremely tang horses and all sorts of things that we used to restore. So it was very interesting. And that, and I used to make a lot of things with my hands then as well, when I wasn't doing the mending, because we were pretty lazy. If we knew we were going to fly somewhere, we'd fix a few amazing pieces, make enough money,
And then go. I see.
But
okay.
We were young and you could do things like that. And we were the youngest restorers in Paris. There were only about 4 restorers. And they were all over 80. And then we came along. So we really had a fantastic amount of work. And we'd do what we could. Of course, we were very quick.
Yeah.
The old restorers would take 5 or 6 years over a piece. And we didn't.
Yeah.
It took 5 or 6 weeks or something. You know, it made a big difference. And anyway, then the French got difficult with South Africans because it was at the time of apartheid.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult. And they just didn't want us to be in any of the institutions or to be in the schools or anything, so it was really hard.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, and then they introduced visas, which were impossible to get. So we went, my friend Susie went back to South Africa and I went to Vienna. And that was really interesting. but I thought I've got to do something because I was getting a bit bored because we'd been really busy in Paris.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I took a little suitcase full of French baby shoes and took them around Austria in a little VW. And, of course, Austrian feet were 3 times the size of any little French baby's feet, so it was an absolute nightmare squeezing them into these shoes and trying to...
You weren't selling French shoes, tiny French shoes... To Austrian babies.
Yes, large, healthy Austrian
oversized.
Babies.
Okay. How did it go?
With difficulty.
Yeah.
But I did see a lot of Austria. But, you know, and that was the whole thing. Because I was traveling all over, I saw things that I would never otherwise see. You know, I'd go and see all the Dürer triptychs in the churches and the fabulous drawings that he'd do. And it was just so different from what I'd known in South Africa. And even in Paris, though we went to lots of the exhibitions, we were just having such a good time. We really were being enormously cultural.
Yeah.
And so it was just great fun. But, you know, as I said before, it just... Everything you see, every piece of art that you see, everybody you meet, you take something from them, even if it's not conscious. And it just comes back into what you produce afterwards. And that's what's so important about the travel and meeting all sorts of different wonderful people. And that's also where the languages became so important.
Yeah, learning the languages.
Learning the languages opens doors.
I can imagine you needed some German to sell some of those French shoes.
I needed plenty of German.
Yeah, indeed.
I needed French, first of all, to get the shoes.
Yeah, to get the shoes and then the German to sell them, yes, indeed.
But it was an extraordinary thing, and opening up the doors in people's minds, because otherwise I was just yet another stranger. I was a tourist. I was, you know, just another person. And it was really fascinating how people suddenly took notice of you, you know, if you made the effort, and suddenly within a week. I'm very good at picking up language. So even in Turkey, if I would go to Turkey, I'd get my little Berlitz book, and I'd learn to count, and I'd learn a few other really important words. And then we'd go buying carpets or looking at things, and they'd all be deciding in Turkish what they would, what should they charge us.
Yeah.
And I'd say, no, sorry, that's too much. And they'd all just about drop their... drop their knickers. They were so absolutely hysterical about seeing this.
Yeah, of course.
You speak a Turkish, you know?
Okay.
No, not very well, but just enough to know that you're...
So it was an act of survival. So and this business of this kind of globe-trotting, nomadic, vagabond existence was based on the fact of very kind of carefree at the time. You're just traveling from place to place, see what happens, but using that as a sort of way of cashing in and then moving on.
Well, yes and no. It was because of the South African passport. It forced me into being a vagabond, because after a certain time, we weren't allowed to stay, you know, as South Africans in certain countries. And so you'd sort of think, well, where should I go now?
And yeah. Yes.
So, you know, that's what happened.
Okay.
And I'd already done Italian at university and classics, so I was sort of very much interested.
A university was where?
In Johannesburg.
Johannesburg. Okay.
That's where I did my first BA and undergraduate.
Yeah.
And it was just such an interesting degree, but it was all terribly European.
Yeah.
And my father and my mother both encouraged that.
But it was part of the time, wasn't it? You look at Europe. You didn't look into your own kind of own culture, whatever there was, yes?
No, I'm just sort of thinking, because the name of your exhibition soon is Carpe Diem, Seizing the Day. And there's something about being an Antipodean and South African which sort of correlates with the attitude as well, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. I think every day you have to seize. And I just think that's part of the optimism that I try and bring to my paintings as well, because I love that feel-good aspect of things. I like the sort of quality of gaiety that colour and my rather peculiar subject matters as well. They're not particularly dark. They're things that are people that I've seen and ways of interpreting them when I do things en plein air. I do paint outside, but I keep the stuff in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my best pictures are maybe 30, 40-year-old memories, which is crazy. But they suddenly start coming out, and then you suddenly sort of channel into it, and through the colour and through the different brush strokes. And it's so fascinating, because the more you do, the more interesting it becomes, too.
Yes. The more becomes uncovered.
Uncovered.
I mean, there looks a little bit of influence, you know, because your first stop was France, of the Impressionists,
yeah?
Absolutely.
Would you say that came through?
You know, but also, yes, because I think South African art, some of the really good South African artists, like Pierre Neef, who's a Dutchman, but I think he was born in South Africa, or went there when he was very, very young, brought up there. Beautiful, beautiful paintings using the palette. He was later than the Impressionists, slightly.
Yeah.
And those wonderful colours that you get from living in a country with so much light. And you need to put them down on canvas sometimes.
Yeah.
You just need to do that.
Yeah.
And then you meet all these different people of so many different nationalities. I mean, there's 28 languages spoken in South Africa.
Yeah.
You know, so and everybody brings something to it, and their colour and their way of dealing with beads and metal and painting their houses. So you have it all around you, and even if you're not aware of it, you are very aware of it.
You're exposed to it.
Yeah, it's a framework for your life.
And does the ceramics sort of come from... Literally, like, South Africa is quite an earthy place as well. Is there any link there?
Probably, the big pots. Yes, and in fact, I have to say yes, because when I first started, I was making perfectly interesting, unusual things, which I'm not showing on this particular exhibition, but I'm going to have a big ceramic exhibition again. And then I watched an incredible video made watching this woman, this Nigerian, I think she is, or Ghanaian, Madeline Ndondo. She was just fantastic, and the way she coiled pots, and I thought, well, that's me. I'm never going to be a good potter on a wheel. That is how you can make fantastic, great, big, unusual, wonderful things. I mean, the Greeks did it. You know, probably the Egyptians were doing it. Certainly the Africans all do it because it's the way you can use soft clay.
Yeah.
And in that incredible sunshine, things dry quickly and it's wonderful. You know, so definitely, yes, there is an African element about it. But I think that the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, has been a great influence on me. The colours.
Yeah.
That incredible blue.
And this brightness, isn't it?
And there's a light. Mm-hmm. Light and brightness. And it's the limestone and the white sands under the beaches that creates those incredible greeny, pale blue, aquamarine colours, which we don't really get in South Africa because of the wild sea there and the wild... the storms we all get, so everything's churned up and it's all terribly exciting, but you don't get those colours. You do around the Cape sometimes in certain areas, but
I imagine that at some point, particularly what you were saying, that you will have to move from country to country because of the situation, the visa situation or migration situation with South Africans. I presume there was a point of, there have been points in your life, you know, before probably much more than now, where you thought about, did you ever conceive the idea of exploring political issues, your issue or your personality, what it is to be a South African living in Europe, that kind of stuff? Did it ever cross your mind to trying to spread it through your art? Is it something that you rejected consciously, or you have not been interested in that kind of stuff?
Do you know, I was...
Not that I'm saying that you have to have a political art. You say
well,
that,
you know, you're born political. Everybody is a political beast in their own way. And I just had so much of it rammed down my throat when I was at university. Yeah. And I used to just get... It was such a relief to come to Europe that perhaps I did subconsciously reject it.
Yeah.
But then when I was living in New York, I was working for the South African Tourism Board, which is a government agency. Well, I mean, it was the only way to stay in America.
Okay.
You know, you have to... If you want to do things, you've got to make things work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could get a diplomatic visa to do that. And... It was really tough because that's what we did. We did politics all day long.
Yeah.
So when was this?
Was in the early 80s.
Mm.
And it was when there was sort of rent a crowd marching around Citibank every day in New York because they still had offices in South Africa, and then they'd come and beat on our doors, and they'd give us a lot of grief, which was fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, after a while, you just... You either become a total politico, or you just you have to find another way.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I found the other way. Yeah. Though I'm still very aware of it, because you just can't be a South African
and
not be.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I come from a country that almost had a civil war over apartheid in 1981, and I often think that, in general, Europeans and English people don't actually understand the politics of South Africa and apartheid and the boycotts and the difficulties of being a South African.
Yeah.
And you know, they'll go on for quite a long time, really.
Well, it takes generations for it to change.
And that's what I was going to ask you, because your work is very light and very vivacious and very colourful, and I think you just said it as a form of escaping from a political culture.
I think it was that, yes. You know, if you take somebody like William Kentridge, phenomenal South African artist.
Yeah.
And it's very dark, but it's quite extraordinary. And yet he sometimes brings in an element of gaiety in the true sense of fun.
Mm.
But there's always, you know, there's a dagger behind every bit, or there's something really black and difficult. And I just can't bring myself to do that. I've had cancer 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched my husband die and disintegrate through the most unbelievable treatments of acute myeloid leukemia. And, you know, you've just got to say to yourself, you're either going to survive or you're going to, you know, dive into a black hole and draw black paintings. Well, that's not me. I'm afraid it's not me.
Yeah.
You know, I just can't do that. And I might come back to it at some, you know, one day. But just at the moment, I'm just really enjoying
maybe it doesn't help with your survival, you know, maybe with him it does, you know, because I think of Nadine Gordimer, who wrote a lot of, you know, political literature, and is it Kutsaya?
Yes, Kutsaya. Jane Kutsaya, yes.
And there's other people as well.
I mean, anyway. I knew Nadine when I was at university. She was around, and she was sort of part of the sort of the social and art set, and of course writing.
Mm.
And she was fascinating, but that was the path she chose. And I had lots of relatives who spent an awful lot of time not having passports because they weren't allowed to travel. I mean, not allowed to travel within 20 miles of where they lived because they had, political aspirations and friends. And Alan Payton, for instance, was my uncle's greatest friend, and he was the governor of the school that my uncle and aunt had. And because of that, they weren't allowed to move. They literally were not allowed to move. And so there's been politics all over. My cousins, political.
Yeah, I can imagine, yes.
But you learn how to...
Well, it's an enormously political country as well, because I think most people don't understand tribal politics.
Well, the hierarchy of tribal politics, too. And it's still going on. Nothing has changed.
And how fragmented it is too in those tribal politics.
And they also don't understand how difficult it is for South Africans to get out of South Africa through travel restrictions. I mean, the English have now taken away that visa. The rand, how weak it is.
Tell me.
Because I often think to myself, it'd be really nice to hear South African bands.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they exist, but I mean, when you have a currency which is, you know, like £1 gets you 20 odd rand or whatever it is, and how it fluctuates, it's very difficult. So when you got out of South Africa and did what you did, it's remarkable, and it's really good. I mean, you must be quite proud of yourself for doing that. It's not easy. People always forget this kind of thing.
But even the South Africans who are there, they always think, because you live in what they call overseas, they would say, they think you have this charmed life. Well, it's incredibly tough, wherever you are in the world.
But people think about those kind of things. In South America, if you live in a place like Paris or London or New York, you're having a fantastic time. Yeah. Well, nowadays, I think the realities of the stories that come back home, people realize how hard it is.
I think with social media and things
like people do. It's not that.
It's not so hidden, whereas before it was this great mystery.
Exactly. You say, having a fantastic time, having tea every day at 5 o'clock. with the queen or something. But coming back to the political and the personal, it's quite interesting that your art, do you see it as a sort of kind of part of your survival, your optimism?
Definitely. Do you know, after Peter, my husband, died, I still had another whole 12 months of chemotherapy.
Both of you were going through chemo at the same time?
Yes.
Wow.
What happened was they gave him a stem cell transplant. And it goes one or two ways.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he started to disintegrate after about 6 weeks.
Oh, no.
And I saw this, he didn't realize it, and the doctors weren't telling him, and it was pretty frightful. 8 weeks maybe. And I don't know, I knew what was happening. And one day I just put my hand under my arm. There was this great big lump, and I just thought, God's sake, that's all we need. Another bloody illness in the family. Yeah. My poor children, they'd walk into the hospital and they'd turn left to see father and right to see mother. It was pathetic.
Oh, yeah, that's serious. How many children do you have?
I've got 2 boys.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I've also seen someone go horrifically through cancer as well. I understand, and as Juan said, and Joan has written in this piece, your bio and other promotional things, as a part of... Your painting particularly is a part of your spirit.
Yeah.
And it's light and colourful and optimistic, and nature based.
It's very much nature based. I love water and I love that's why I started this whole exhibition doing a lot of fish. And I have to say, after about the 12th fish painting, I thought, I'll never paint another bloody fish in my life. But of course you do, because suddenly you think, oh, those are so interesting. And you start observing things differently.
Yes.
So I I was in the Far East at Christmas with the boys, and yeah. seeing all those incredible fish, it was wonderful. The koi carp, quite extraordinary, and the way they have their relationship to nature is also was so different.
And the colours of their gills, and the colours of the ocean, and the colours of the day.
Exactly.
And
your
rainbow trout. I mean, I'm not a painter, but you could probably paint fish forever, to be honest, with
you
if you like colours.
Yeah, you could.
And reflections. Scales.
I could get a picture of a fish from an Audubon book, but I can't paint like that. But it's boring. I like to just get the paint and get the big brushes and start painting and I often just start with colour and then it becomes a subject rather than saying, okay, today I'm going to paint a fish. I have a lot of underpainting too, and I sometimes find my best paintings are painted over other paintings, which I hated. And then I show a picture to somebody of the old painting and say, well, where's that one? I say, well, it's gone. Oh, no. But you get extraordinary effects having a painting underneath a painting.
And when something like chemotherapy just saps everything. Oh. I mean, it kills cells, right? That's what it does. So the energy level and one's colour that's quite a fight, huh?
Well, I went back and did a BA Fine Arts because I thought I needed the discipline to get up in the morning with my dog and the Fine Arts degree.
Yeah.
I forced myself to actually do something. And it was damn exhausting, I can tell you.
Yeah.
As you say, and you think you're better when you finish the chemo, but it actually takes a couple of years. And then suddenly you realise that you weren't better at all. But now you are. Now I am. It's fantastic.
It's terrific. You can see your energy and spirit.
Incredible.
And colour.
And also, you're a portrait artist too. You paint portraits. Tell us about that. It seems to be portraits mostly of Indian faces for these exhibitions.
You've got Sikhs here,
Sikhs.
You've got African lady.
Yeah.
I just love...
You have Sikhs.
I love colour. The colour of the skin.
Okay.
Mm. It's wonderful. It's very difficult to actually get good white skin tones.
Yeah.
It's not. I mean, you just have to work at it a bit more. But there's that incredible sort of warmth of facial colour. And Indian men are so absolutely devastatingly handsome as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly wonderful aquiline features.
Yeah.
And the women are fabulous. And now in Johannesburg, you go to the local market on a Sunday and there are people from all over Africa who I never saw when I was growing up because they weren't allowed in. We weren't allowed into their countries, nor were they into us. And since, Mandela and the whole change of South Africa, the new South Africa, I met a Malian, most beautiful woman from Mali.
Yeah.
And she allowed me to paint her, and she was just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And every time I go now, I find somebody else, and I was in Kenya, and I've met a wonderful Ugandan, and I've done a Kenyan, it's not in this exhibition, but... I love they've just got wonderful faces too. And you just want to explore them. I did a young Chinese girl actually in Hong Kong. She was Eurasian, so half Chinese, and incredible skin tones because it wasn't yellow, it wasn't pink, it was just the most beautiful colour. And
it's so difficult to get those colours right, isn't it?
You just got to work at it, and that's why I like to work in oils.
Yeah.
I was going to ask whether you work in oil or water.
Yeah.
I used to work in water a lot. That's all I did, actually. But now I work in oils. I just think you can get an incredible depth with oils.
With colour.
And translucence.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you need the light, so you need to be able to pick up all those things. And the oil, working in oil, for instance, the one with the beard, or they both, the one in the coloured turban, I just absolutely loved painting his... moustache, absolutely brilliant white moustache, which he sort of tied around his ears, and a wonderful, gorgeous thing, and he was just such an incredible man. And then there was another one who was terribly, confused by the fact that a woman was painting him, but he wasn't going to move away, he enjoyed it. And then this little lady from Siam, she was from Siem Reap, she was selling chickens. literally
Cambodia.
Yeah, in Cambodia, and she was just sitting there, and she was just the sweetest face.
Excellent.
You know, and it was wonderful.
And the techniques and the themes very much within the European tradition of painting, very much you could see a bit of Degas there, a bit of Matisse, there's a bit of Turner. It's quite interesting, one of your paintings about northern dogs, and it's the only one I can detect some kind of darker colours. They are much more metallic colours rather than, you know, the other ones.
Well, yes, went up to Newcastle and all around there in time. And it is much darker there.
It is darker.
It's darker.
The colour is different, yeah.
The colours are different. Hadrian's Wall was fantastic. And I must put that down on paper one day as well. But it was just something that was, again, starting from colour. And then it started to turn into itself. It turned into the docks and the great big ships. And when you look at it carefully, there are about five or six ships in it, but you're only really aware of the big one first, the red one, and then you look and see, and you pick them up.
Yeah.
But
is the aesthetic revelation, at least for you, comes through colour always, or form, more colour than form?
Colour becomes the form, and then I draw into it, or paint into it, and that's where the underpainting is so important.
But with a painting like the Northern Dogs, the beauty comes from appreciating the colour at some particular moment.
Yes.
This colour, however dark it is, is beautiful in its own nature.
But it's also the colour and the geometry.
Okay.
Because just colour on a painting isn't particularly interesting unless there's something that draws you into it. And I like to do roads, for instance, so you are drawn into the picture.
The perspective.
You walk up that road into the painting. And that's all about geometry, basically. It's taking you into a point and perspective. And I do like that. And I love, again, also aerial views. I've done a lot of aerial views. And most of them, people sort of love them. They don't understand them. It's sort of bird's eye view.
How do you approach those paintings if you're painting mostly from memory?
I presume I'm a bird.
Ah.
Or I go and stand on a very high point.
Okay.
And I get the look into my brain, because quite often you can't paint out there because it's too windy or too wet, and you know, so I take it back inside.
Yeah.
I might take a picture. But photographs, I don't paint from photographs because they're too stilted and they make them inflexible. And there's too much detail in the photographs.
And in terms of portrait artists, what do you think about the dominance within the British art of portrait of somebody like Freud? Do you think it's because he painted from photographs sometimes and in the way he did it? What do you think about that, his techniques?
I think he could paint really well. I think he can draw really well, he could. But I find most of his paintings really quite disturbing.
Painful.
Yeah, rather painful, exactly. And I feel sorry for the sitters, really. Sorry. But it's an extraordinary thing. English people like having their papers done of them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I do children's commissions for babies and things like that. And for grannies, because they just love it.
Do you think that comes from the culture of kings and queens and
absolutely.
Aristocracy? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, if you saw that Charles II exhibition at the RA, absolutely phenomenal. But they were all people. I can't think there was one.
They become
if you think about the Tudors, which is an obsession within the British educational system, particularly you're in secondary school, you will do the Tudors. And one of the reasons why you do the Tudors is because they go to Holbein's there, painting them. Mm-hmm. They became the first photogenic, in inverted commas, royal family.
Yes.
So for us, they become suddenly colourful. And not only the story is colourful, but also the portraits are colourful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this kind of portrait artists, Britain didn't have portrait artists, they have to import it from the northern countries, because they couldn't paint portraits here in this country.
Well, in the 18th century and 17th century,
but we're talking about 17th century, early 17th century.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. They were much more interested in landscape, quite frankly.
Indeed.
And because I think also the people who were commissioning the paintings had the great parks, had the great landscape that they wanted to have for keeps. And it's only then when they sort of thought, oh, actually, you know, this chap's rather good, I think I'll get him to paint my wife, you know, my children, in fact. Yes, why not me as well, you know?
Yeah, so. Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it happens in a country like a very affluent country like Holland, for example, becomes what anybody with money will pay to get the, you know, people to paint, to be painted. And still life became a major predominant thing because it was part of, in certain ways, not only the secular view of painting, because we are moving away from God representation of power into something much more simplistic.
Yes.
And that simplicity came from the affluence of the Dutch merchant families, asking these painters, just paint whatever you want to paint, from portrait, but also the still life.
Well, it's interesting because they had also moved away from Catholicism.
Yeah, indeed.
And which was, of course, that ghastly religious art, though not all of it was ghastly, I mean, some of it was extraordinary. But early on, you know, Michelangelo and
the Renaissance painting.
Wonderful, amazing. And, you know, just extraordinary. And then suddenly, Dutch are very practical people. They want to see what they, you know, what they see. They wanted those painted, as you say, it was everyday life.
But some people argue that part of the evolution of portrait painting came from Protestantism, and the whole thing moving away from religious representation. So you have another representation, the human person, the civitas, the normal individual. Mm-hmm. You are not talking about deities, you're not talking about nobility, you're not talking about kings or mythical figures, you're talking about the person that you live with.
Yes.
So then you got people like Vermeer painting a woman reading a letter, or people having a beer in the garden, which is fantastic. I think it's brilliant.
Well, also, just remember...
In the way it's done, anyway.
Yeah, we didn't have any other way of portraying things.
Portraying, yes.
You know, it had to be drawn. I mean, when you couldn't send a photograph of yourself, so you got somebody to paint a little miniature, or a big miniature, you know, or a big painting, and that's what you sent. So people suddenly knew who you were. And think, oh, my God, you know, he's gorgeous. Oh, my God. He's ghastly, Daddy, please don't make me marry him.
Yes, please.
So it was an incredibly important thing.
Well, huge. Think about Henry VIII, his third wife. He recommended Holbein went to paint. He used to be introduced to these prospective queens through painting.
Yes.
And his third wife, the painting was much better than the real thing.
And
when he saw the real thing, he didn't like it at all.
Oh, she was terribly ugly, actually.
And in fact, she was quite plain. And that was one of the reasons why Thomas Cromwell lost his head. One of the reasons, but that was one of the main factors. He fell out of favors with Henry.
He brought back the wrong picture.
Yeah, the wrong picture, or, the wrong models. Oh, look at this. That's not true, you know.
But, people have always wanted to have decoration. Look at the Egyptians. Look in the incredible tombs in the Egyptian art. Look at the cave paintings, even earlier. Wonderful.
But no, I tell you what is interesting. Look at the Islamic art, where within the orthodoxy of Islam, you are not supposed to represent any nature or any animal or person because that belongs to Allah. How platonic that concept is.
Mm.
That the whole representation, figurative art, is out of the question because that's the realm of Allah. So look at the calligraphy, how it becomes sophisticated, that it's almost ornamental.
Mm.
You know Arabic.
Yeah,
you're right. So we like representation to the point where representation is not allowed.
But Georgie's done one of my favourite pieces here called Amani Fisherman in the Very Early Morning.
Yes.
So that's a little bit haram, maybe.
Well, maybe. But you go on, you know.
Wow.
The thing was, it was absolutely.
I'm stirring
haram.
Here.
Yeah, no, I hope you should. Have you been to Oman? It's absolutely rather. It's the most beautiful place, and they're also incredibly charming people.
Yeah.
But we loved to go and see the fish markets, and it was out of Muscat, actually, and going up the coast a bit. And they fish in these tiny boats. And in the very early morning, because of the heat and the fog, the sea fog, and sort of waiting for it to clear, and they're all there in their, you know, the Arab clothing and look like fishermen dress anywhere else in the world, and they just jump into these amazing tiny boats and off they go. And then at the end of the day or halfway through, they come back with these mega catches, and that's the next series of paintings. You see, this, it's just so interesting seeing all these, and just, you know, sort of five meter high of sardines, because it's slightly, or two or three ships, you know, ships, they're not ships at all, they're tiny boats, come in, and the chap's just sitting with their legs crossed on the beach, and then the little fish market is up on the top of the dune, and you know, the women are all working in the fish market, and the chaps have brought in, you know, the fish, and if they don't have a wife, they're just sitting on the sand and hope somebody will come and buy it. But it was absolutely wonderful, and that was that sort of early morning, that moment before the sun had started to clear the fog, and it almost looks like an angel nurse, the one who's standing in front of the boat. And I didn't mean to do that at all. It just sort of came.
Incredible.
Came like that.
Mm. Full of colour, that painting.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for you to get away from fish, you see. There are no man, and
yeah.
I mean, you go to Sri Lanka, you would be stuffed.
But all these places with fish. Beautiful light will be by the sea, almost.
The next trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't get inspired by mountains, or
I do. There are a few.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was in Iceland last year.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, amazing.
And
place.
The glacier melting, the colours are quite extraordinary, because it's sort of a black and white country, but it's not black and white at all. So by May, and it happened to be very warm last May.
Yeah.
Everything was starting to just bounce out of the ground. It was marvellous. And riding those wonderful little Icelandic horses, and down the fjords at low tide on this black glacial sand, and then you'd go to another part, and there was blue skies, and these white glaciers sort of on the horizon, and it's just a completely unusual country, and the lava fields, which are sort of black in the winter and then they turn green and red in the summer, and berries just coming on, little yellow flowers here and there, and the whole thing, you know, and you just have these flashes of colour wherever you go, and so it's not a black and white country at all.
Yeah.
No.
It's just wonderful.
I was there in the winter. It's pretty dark.
It's bleak, but, yeah.
It's about 3 or 4 hours of sunlight a day.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
It's amazing. So if you had to sort of, do you see that you like, do you paint for a while and then sort of get sort of semi-exhausted or tired of it and then go into ceramics? Or is there any of that kind of dynamic that goes on with you? Or do you switch?
I did, but now...
Or you paint on a ceramic?
I paint on my ceramics. But then I became much more interested in the glazes, so the coloured glazes. But the early works were painted, a lot of decorated, sort of polychrome. And I came back to it when I did my little paper bag series of pots. And it was rather fun doing it again. It was sort of Matisse, it was Cocteau, it was Picasso, you know. And it was great fun doing that again. Because you've got to have a really good technician who understands the firing of the glazes. Because you think, okay, I'm going to put this red glaze on. And it comes out of the fire and it's sort of a nasty brown. And you sort of think, but that's not my piece. You know. And so in the end, I just stopped assuming that if I painted red on something or whatever colour it was, it would be red. Terribly fugitive colours, and a yellow as well, and pink, and even blues are quite fugitive. So it was interesting then to paint on top of biscuitware that I'd made.
I like that expression, fugitive colours. Nice.
Well, you know,
could be a name that for the next exhibition.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of have been a fugitive in a way.
Yeah.
As well.
I have.
Yeah, yes. You have been. Yeah, fugitive colours from a fugitive artist somehow.
Yeah.
I'm fugitive from dreadful things or dreadful, you know, realities in
your
lives too.
Right. Yeah.
Which is good, isn't it? It's good to be fugitive from bad news and stuff.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, you can't be a victim in life. If you're a victim, nothing happens.
Yeah.
And you've just
hence carpe diem.
Yeah, carpe diem. You've got to get up and you've just got to do something. And every morning I wake up and I think something good's going to happen today. Don't know what it is, but it will. And you have that feeling that rises, lifts you out of bed and the rest of the day. And good things do happen.
I was going to say, I'm always interested in people's work ethic and their process, because I think a lot of people who haven't been involved in art just sort of think that things happen and it looks
that
good,
is easy.
You've written that and you made that. So, do you do this full time now?
It's 8 to 10 to 18 hours a day.
It has become, you know.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make itself, as you say.
Yeah.
Mm. Art is not easy. It is jolly hard physical work.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting because you are putting out all the time. And without energy, you can't create. So you're expending energy. And, okay, so you go away for, an hour or two here. But then you suddenly come back and you suddenly see something. You think, that's what it needs. And then sometimes you might need to hang it on the wall for a month.
And then one day you come back to it.
Yes, I've got a space in my bedroom, which I keep, which is quite a big piece, quite a big area, so that I can put things there. And I'll wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and I think, yeah, that's what it needs. And it's just an extraordinary thing because it suddenly happens. If you force it all at once, it doesn't always happen. Sometimes it works. Sometimes, it's got that immediacy and it's spontaneous and it really works. But then sometimes it needs more time. So does it? I mean, some of the pictures take 3 years to paint. It's not just doing it straight away.
And tell us a little bit about the curatorial aspect of Carpe Diem. It was something that, things that you wanted to put in the exhibition to show to the public.
Yes.
Or there was something much more specific about something in particular or not?
I think it was my travels in my head.
Yeah.
And also, carpe, there was a bit of a pun on the word carp, because of course all the koi carp
that
I was doing. But that was just by the way. But the carpe diem, I think, is so important. I try and get that into my children's head as well, and everybody I meet. And that's work ethic as well. Because if you don't have a work ethic, nothing happens.
But as a world ethic survivor, I mean, in certain ways, you need to be a survivor to appreciate the carpe diem in its full intensity somehow.
I'm a three-time survivor.
Also, the idea of sort of starting out and not knowing where it's going to go, but following it. Do you do a lot of that?
Yeah, well, that's where I start with colour.
Yeah.
And it becomes things.
Yeah. So you don't have too much pre-planned and you go into the unknown.
Sometimes I do. I have an idea that I'm going to do something, but it never really becomes what I first thought. Because sometimes it doesn't work on canvas. And I paint with a lot of gesso underneath. So I gesso my canvases and that's where the underpainting comes. And you get structure. You get structure, you get geometry from that. But that's all in white, so... And then the colour comes on top of it, and it creates interesting lines, interesting textures.
Intensifies the colour?
Yes, maybe, but it's structure, which is what's so interesting.
One of the final questions, because we are running out of time now, but I was talking about moving away from your comfort zone, not necessarily in a bad way, but I think when you were talking about somebody like Goya. For example, I went to see this Goya exhibition, beautiful Goya exhibition, about a year ago at the National Gallery. And the revelation was felt self-taught completely, trying to get into the Academy of Arts in Madrid, never managed. But at the age of 50, he was running the Academy of Arts. But also how he became better and better as he grew older and older. His late paintings were brilliant, brilliant compared to stuff. And I'm thinking about... It's clear that you lie a lot of European artists, particularly the French, and I just wonder, for example, different kind of themes like city landscapes, where color, different composition of color, and I just wonder if it's something that you have been working on, have considered, or how does it work for you?
Well, I never thought I could do much perspective, and so I used to steer away from them. Because cities require a bit of perspective,
indeed.
Otherwise they just fall apart.
And the geometry, of course, of cities.
And geometry, but as I've been doing it, I've been training myself, forcing myself to do it, and working on those things. So that is really out of my comfort zone, doing things like that. And it's been a really fascinating journey.
It just came to me, out of the ether. When you were speaking of Goya, I haven't seen it, but you know Robert Hughes, the Australian art critic?
Yeah, critic.
And a friend of my father's, a very prominent painter, said that when Robert Hughes got in a serious car accident, a very serious car accident, like horrific, and he was in the hospital for like 15 or 16 months, and he wrote a book on Goya. It might even be called The Ghosts of Goya, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But he wrote this book, and he said that actually looking at those paintings revived him and helped him come back into, you know, into life and things, because he was so badly hurt.
My goodness.
Wow. So there's something about
the healing power of art.
Yeah, because it's very visual. It's obviously a very visual medium, isn't it? It's not like, you know, undertaking a long novel and a long, you know,
but it requires certain mediation from you. It's also the case, isn't it? You to really enjoy it.
You have to make it. Whether it's a piece of ceramic or a sculpture, you have to make it. You know, I make dog's heads for people. And you've got to go and look at the dogs. You can't just think, okay, well, today I'll do a poodle. I've got to walk around London until I see 20 poodles. And that's how the dogs then have a livelihood.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and they get a person.
I never thought about that. You open a new kind of branch now for me. Portrait of dogs. I never imagined about kind of stuff, you know. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a pleasure. And we'd just like to say to the listeners and people listening on podcasts that Georgie's exhibition, Carpe Diem, an exhibition of paintings and sculptures by her, runs from the 11th to the 16th of June, open daily between 10:30 and 6, at La Galleria, Royal Opera Arcade, 5 Paul Mall, London, SW1Y, 4UY. So, all the best with that, and if anyone else is interested in going to that, we recommend that you do. But on behalf of myself, Juan, extraradio1.com, Artefacto, and ztrradio.podomatic.com, Georgie, thank you very much for coming along.
Well, thank you, Georgie.
So enjoyed it. Thank you both.
Thank you.
As well.
Thank you for coming. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Septia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.